Right, well, this will be the fourth installment of this study, I think. And I actually have about three or four more, believe it or not, after this. So I think maybe three more after this. So last time we left off, if you heard the recording, we left off talking about defending yourself, how we do have the right to defend ourselves. And then I took a little sabbatical based on some questions, and I talked about that just all by itself, about self-defense and when do we resist and when do we not resist. So now I want to jump back into this, and where I left off here, and I didn't bring an outline for you, so I guess it won't matter telling you where I am in the outline, but I left off right before this idea that non-intervention is not isolationism. And I'm basically only going to define some terms here and then move on with this, but this is one of the common things that people say about non-intervention is that it's isolationism, and that's one of the things that people got on Ron Paul about back in 2008. They called him an isolationist. And so just to lay that one to rest with a couple dictionary definitions, isolationism is the policy of seeking political or national isolation with special reference to the USA. This is right out of the Oxford English Dictionary. Now, isolationism is the policy of seeking isolation. Isolation is the action of isolating, go figure, the fact or condition of being isolated or standing alone, separate from other things or persons, solitariness. And to isolate is to place or set apart or alone, to cause to stand alone, detached, separate, unconnected with other things or persons, to insulate. So I don't know if you remember, and I don't have that part of the outline, but non-intervention was to not intervene in other people's affairs where you're not directly affected. If you're not directly threatened, then you don't intervene in the internal affairs of other nations. So it's quite different from isolationism. Isolationism is we just stay away, we don't trade with you, we don't talk with you, we close down our borders, and we have no contact with anybody else at all. And that's not what non-intervention's about at all. We say, like the founders, and I'll get into this in probably next study, I think I have a whole bunch of quotes from the founders, but like Jefferson said, peace, commerce, and trade with all nations, entangling alliances with none. So the founders certainly weren't against trade and such. I mean, they weren't isolationists, but they were most definitely non-interventionists. So this is, right now I want to get into the crux of this whole study. This is really what I wanted to get into when I first started, like a month ago, and I kind of built up to it with all this other stuff. So this is, you're getting to hear in person the best one, in my opinion. So,
timing is
everything.
Yes. I can handle that.
So, I've put a little dash in this word, international, because I wanted to focus on the fact of international, meaning across nations or, you know, among nations. International conduct should, or at least sometimes can be, governed by the same principles in the New Testament as interpersonal conduct. And this is I'm going to be building on this idea, because as you look through the New Testament, you don't find a whole lot of commandments or teachings on how nations should relate to each other. There may be a little bit in there here and there, but there's not a whole lot of direct instruction about how nations would interact with each other. So as I got thinking about this, I thought, you know, I think I could make a case, and a pretty good one, that nations can be treated as they're interacting with each other, can be treated as individuals. And, you know, if you just follow me through, I think I'll be able to flesh this out pretty well. Now, this type of thing can break down if you say, well, we can treat a group of people like another group of people. If a certain law is given to individuals, then we can extrapolate that out to other things. That doesn't always work. For instance, biblical laws regulating the actions of a government towards its citizens are not always the same as the laws regulating the actions of an individual to another individual. So I can't say, for instance, where it gives a government a right to punish somebody with the sword, one of its citizens, if they break the law, I can't say, well, then, okay, I can extrapolate that and say, if I'm dealing with a person, I can deal with them with a sword. You know, that doesn't work. We have a different relationship. Person-to-person relationship is different than government-to-citizen relationship. The government is an authority over its citizenry. This is distinctly different from the relationship that two individuals have with each other. The civil authority has the power of the sword, like I just mentioned, to execute vengeance on them that do evil. We see that in Romans 13, 1 through 4. In Romans 13, 1 through 4, just to give you an example of how all laws don't work across all different groups of men all the time if there are distinctions to be made. Romans 13, 1 through 4, let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. I think it's interesting. There are so many phrases that we use today that come right out of the old King James Bible. The powers that be. You know, we say that all the time, the powers that be. Right there, that's where it comes from. The skin of your teeth. You know, Job talked about the skin of his teeth. The scum of the earth. The offscouring of the earth. There's all kinds of phrases that we get from this old King James Bible, which is interesting. Verse 2. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power resisteth the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same. Wouldn't it be nice if we actually had a government that did that, that praised them that are good and punished them that are bad? We have just the opposite. I'll get into that at the end of the study. For he is the minister of God to thee for good, but if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain, for he is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. So we can't extrapolate from that and say, I can revenge evil with the sword to my neighbor if he offends me or if he does something, if he, you know, steals my pottery out of the front yard or something like that. We can't do that. There are different laws concerning that. And just for a proof of that, if you look in the previous chapter, Romans chapter 12, verses 17 through 20, it says, recompense to no man evil for evil, provide things honest in the sight of all men, if it be possible, as much as lieth in you, live peaceably with all men. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. So we're supposed to give place unto wrath, but in verse 4 of chapter 13, it says that he's the revenger to execute wrath upon them that doeth evil. So clearly government can do things that we can't do. So we can't always say, well, government should relate to people just like individuals relate to people or to each other. That wouldn't work. But in the case of international conduct, the nations are peers of each other, not authorities and subordinates. You think about that. When it comes to us and our government, they're in authority over us as citizens. When it comes to nations, the United States and Iran, for instance, the United States isn't an authority over Iran. We may think we are, we may try to be, but we are peers. Now, the United Nations might be an authority, which is, that's a whole other story, and I'm not even talking about that. That's ungodly and unbiblical anyway. But anyway, nations are peers, just like individuals are peers. And nations are comprised of individuals. So it's like when you look at society, it's just a collection of individuals. So you have a collection of individuals interacting with a collection of individuals, not one in authority over the other. So you can see there's a difference there. Nations are even referred to as individuals, such as the nations of Israel and Edom, who were referred to as their, quote, founding fathers, Jacob and Esau. Got some Bible for this back in Genesis 25:23. Genesis 25:23, we see here that these nations were referred to as the men that were their progenitors. Genesis 25 and verse 23. This is speaking to Rebekah when she was about to have Jacob and Esau. And the Lord said unto her, two nations are in thy womb, and two manner of people shall be separated from thy bowels, and the one people shall be stronger than the other people, and the elder shall serve the younger. It says, two nations are in thy womb. And he's talking about two little children, two little boys, that would turn into two nations. And Jacob and Esau were later referred to the nations of Israel and Edom, which Edom is another name for Esau and Israel is another name for Jacob. Those nations were referred to as individuals, using singular pronouns like thou and he and that kind of thing. I'll show you an example of that in Numbers 20:17 through 22. Numbers 20:17 to 22. So this is when Israel had come out of Egypt, and they were passing through the wilderness, and they were heading towards the promised land, and they came to Edom, and Moses was sent a messenger to speak to the leader of Edom and ask them, if we can just pass through, we're going to pass through, we won't take anything, we're not, I think this was the one where they said they'd even pay him for any food that their animals ate or any water they drank or anything. So if you look here in Numbers 27, starting in verse 17, this is whenever Israel's talking to Edom. Let us pass, I pray thee, through thy country. Now I want you to notice all the singular pronouns. I pray thee through thy country. We will not pass through the fields or through the vineyards, neither will we drink of the water and the wells. We will go by the king's highway. We will not turn to the right hand nor to the left until we have passed thy border. So it's clearly talking about the nation of Israel. And Edom said unto him, thou shalt not pass by me, lest I come out against thee with the sword. And the children of Israel said unto him, we will go by the highway, and if I and my cattle drink of thy water, see how he's flip-flopping we and I, they're referring to the nation as individuals and corporately. And if I and my cattle drink thy water, then I will pay for it. I will only without doing anything else go through on my feet. And he said, thou shalt not go through. And Edom came out against him with much people and with a strong hand. Thus Edom refused to give Israel passage through his border, wherefore Israel turned away from him. How far was I going to go? 22. And the children of Israel, even the whole congregation, journeyed from Kadesh and came unto Mount Hor. So you see there that Israel and Edom were referred to as individuals there. He and thou, and at times they also referred to as we. But you have two nations there referred to as the two men that were their original founders. So you have nations there being treated as individuals. He says, let me go through your land. He says, no, you're not going through my land. You know, so we see there how nations are interacting with each other as individuals would. Jesus used an example of how a nation would count the cost when deciding to go to war with another nation to illustrate how an individual should count the cost when deciding to follow him. So if you remember this in the Gospel of Luke, in Luke 14, Jesus was talking to people about counting the cost to be a disciple. And he uses an example of a king going to war against another king and the king counting the cost, seeing if he has enough men to attack another king, another kingdom. And Jesus uses this as an example that if you're going to follow Christ, count the cost. See if you're willing to give up whatever's necessary. In Luke 14, 31 through 33. I made reference to this in the last study too, I think. It says, or what king, going to make war against another king, sitteth not down first, and consulteth whether he be able with 10,000 to meet him that cometh against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is yet a great way off, he sendeth an ambassage and desireth conditions of peace. So likewise, whosoever he be of you that forsaketh not all that he hath, he cannot be my disciple. You see how Jesus uses an example of a nation going to war against another nation, and he uses that as a pattern or as an example of an individual deciding if they want to follow Christ or not and counting the cost. So he's using a nation as an example for an individual is all I'm driving at there. Therefore, some of the same laws and principles in Scripture that should apply to international conduct or some of the same laws and principles in Scripture should apply to international conduct as apply to interpersonal conduct. And as we go further through this, I can even prove that more strongly because I'm going to show you that God judges Babylon and refers to him as he and him, refers to him as an individual, and judges him for doing the very things that he judges people for doing. And I'll show you that individual. I will show you that in just a minute. So let's look at the principles of non-intervention with this idea that God treats that some of the same laws in the Bible that apply to individuals apply to nations. Let's look at the principles of non-intervention. The following points apply to individuals and also apply to nations as well, as will be shown based on, like what I said, based on Babylon, God's dealings with Babylon. We can see that these same things that apply to individuals apply to nations also. Number one, mind your own business. Okay, that's one that we are told as Christians to do. And we had a saying in the Army, stay in your own lane. And that was something that we said all the time. It doesn't, you'd think it would come from driving down the road when you're in your own lane in the road. It comes from when you're at the range and you have these lanes, each person has their own lane and you have targets on there and you don't want to be shooting at another guy's targets, especially if they're pop-up targets, because if you knock his down, he gets a point and you lose one, so it doesn't help you at all. But anyway, stay in your own lane. You don't want to crossfire. And then, of course, that is used in all kinds of applications just to say, mind your own business. Stay in your own lane. Don't meddle with strife that's not belonging to you. So let's look at it in Proverbs 26. And if there is one thing, if I could give probably just one piece of advice to President Obama, stay in your own lane. Mind your own business in the military-industrial complex and all the whole thing. Mind your own business. Stay out of other people's affairs. Stay out of my affairs and stay out of other nations' affairs, for that matter. Proverbs 26 and verse 17 says, he that passeth by and meddleth with strife belonging not to him is like one that taketh a dog by the ears. All right, so you can imagine what would happen if you went up to a dog, go up to a big Doberman pincher, and grab him by both of the ears just like this. And so what's going to happen? You're going to get bitten. He's going to turn around and snap you, and you're going to wish you wouldn't have done that. But that's the same thing that happens to the guy that passes by and meddles with strife not belonging to him. You walk by and you see two people in an argument and you jump in and say, hey, let me mediate here. I want to help you guys out. Well, all of a sudden, you probably will help them out because they're not going to be mad at each other. They're going to be mad at you, and they're both going to jump on you. So stay in your own lane. And I happen to have in my Bible written next to this, Libya, Syria, ? So anyway, I have lots of that type of notes written in my Bible here and there. Stay in your own lane. That's the number one thing. Don't be a busybody in other men's matters. Look at what first, and just think about, I mean, our foreign policy, meddling with strife that doesn't belong to us. Here we go over just recently in Libya, last year, 2 years ago, whenever it was, yet the rebels are trying to overthrow Gaddafi, and instead of just leaving them be, we go over there, establish a no-fly zone, and help out the rebels, who then end up being Al-Qaeda, who were supposedly trying to fight in Afghanistan. Then along comes Syria. And you got a civil war going on in Syria, and 100,000 people have been killed. And instead of just it sounds terrible to just let them alone, but you're not going to help them any. So we go over there, we grab the dog by the ears, now we start shipping them weapons. I can't say I guarantee it, but I am certain that we will be in there militarily, and I personally think that that whole thing is going to blow up into a huge mess. It's just we never learn our lesson. We don't mind our own business with anything. We've been in Afghanistan for 12 years. We were in Iraq for all those years. We lost thousands of lives, killed hundreds of thousands of people. And the place is a bigger mess than whenever we got there now. There's people being killed there all the time. It's terrible. We don't mind our own business. 1 Peter 4 and verse 15. Don't be a busybody in other people's matters. First Peter 4 and verse 15. And I'm sure we've all heard these sermons preached at us. You know, you probably haven't heard these exact verses used to talking about our government, but it applies to them too. 1 Peter 4:15. But let none of you suffer as a murderer, or as a thief, or as an evildoer, or as a busybody in other men's matters. I always found that interesting. There is a busybody, which would seem to be a small sin, quote-unquote, to us, lumped right in there with murderers, thieves, and evildoers. And I just got thinking about this. In this context, you think about it, it makes perfect sense that they're lumped in there with murderers, thieves, and evildoers. I mean, we go over there, we murder thousands and thousands of people. I mean, we're dropping bombs on people in Yemen, in Pakistan, in Somalia, killing people. I mean, I just saw a documentary the other day. It's terribly sad. We got these pilots over in New Mexico, 8,000 miles away from these places, and all they're watching is on a camera, and they see people acting suspiciously from, 20,000 feet in the sky, how you can tell somebody's acting suspiciously. They see a whole group of people get together. What it turned out to be was they were just, and I forget what it's called, but they were having a political meeting, like a town hall meeting kind of thing to try to hash something out. It was a very democratic process. And they thought this was some big terrorist meetup, and they dropped a whole bunch of Hellfire missiles on them, killed a whole ton of people. And that little village had, prior to that, been sympathetic to the United States, and been friendly to the United States, and that whole village now, of course, has turned against us and they hate us because we just killed a bunch of their family and everything else. It's just, it's terrible. So yeah, it makes perfect sense. Let nobody suffer as a murderer, a thief, or as an evildoer. I mean, we go over there in Iraq and we, get rights to all that oil and ransack some of those museums with all those artifacts and everything and get into all that stuff. But anyway, murdering thieves and evildoers and busybodies, not minding our own business. And people resent you, and anybody knows this just from dealing with people. People resent you for getting in the middle of their fights. Turn over to Exodus 2, 13 through 14 for an example of this. Why do we think we'd be any different? I mean, we wonder, why do they hate us? Is it because we're free and prosperous and have a democracy and we're rich? No, they hate us because we're over there dropping bombs on them. I'd hate you if you were dropping bombs on me too. I mean, you talk about terrorists. Just think about it. You can't see those drones flying. I mean, they're flying thousands of feet in the air. You'd just literally be walking down the road and a huge explosion would go off. You'd have no idea where it came from, and you'd be half afraid to ever leave your house because I could be walking with a walking stick. Some psycho in New Mexico is looking at on a picture, sees me with a walking stick. Oh, he's got a gun. He's a terrorist. Boom. You talk about terrorizing people. We are terrorizing people. I shouldn't say we. I'm not doing it. They are terrorizing people. I'm tired of referring to the government as we. It's not we, it's they. They're the ones that are doing it. Unfortunately, we're the morons that elected them. So anyway, Exodus 2, 13 through 14. This is when Moses saw an Egyptian that was smiting his fellow Hebrew, and he jumped in the day before. He jumps in and he saves the guy and killed the Egyptian. And he was actually, if you look in Acts chapter 7, verse 24, he was defending the guy. You wouldn't get that from this passage in Exodus, but he was actually defending the guy. He just didn't murder somebody out of cold blood or something. So it says there in verse 13, "And when he went out the second day, behold, two men of the Hebrews strove together, and he said to him that did the wrong, Wherefore smitest thou thy fellow? And he said, Who made thee a prince and a judge over us? Intendest thou to kill me as thou killedst that Egyptian, or killedst the Egyptian?" So here Moses is going to go in there and meddle with strife not belonging to him. He's like, "Hey, why'd you smite that guy? Let me help you guys out. I want to make peace between you." And he said, "Who made you a ruler and a judge over me? You going to kill me like you killed him?" You know, people don't receive that kind of thing well when you meddle in their business when it doesn't belong to you. So is it any wonder why they hate us? It's called blowback. You know, even if you believe the official 9/11 story, which I don't, but if you do believe it, I think Ron Paul's done a beautiful job of this. I can't imagine he actually believes it. Maybe he does. He won't admit it to be political suicide, I'm sure, to admit that you don't believe the story. But he uses the story against them and says that the reason that Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, whoever, gave for attacking us on 9/11 was because we had troops in the Holy Land in Saudi Arabia. It was blowback. And we received blowback in Iran, too, in 1953 when we overthrew the Mossadegh, the democratically elected leader of Iran. BP Oil wanted to, they had set up all the oil rigs in there, and Mossadegh wasn't getting any money for his own country, so he threw them out of there. Well, so in comes the CIA, we set up a coup, throw out Mossadegh, they set up the Shah, Shah's a brutal dictator, and then in 1979, then they take the hostages, and we get blowback from it. And then Americans, "Oh, why do they hate us? Why do they take our hostages?" Well, nobody knows the CIA went in there at that time instead of a coup and overthrew their government. But that's what happens. We go over, we meddle in other people's affairs, and then the blowback comes. And the definition of blowback is unintended consequences, but that the people, the general population, doesn't know. They don't realize what's going on. Most people probably don't even know we're having drone warfare over in Pakistan and Yemen. I mean, unless you read alternative media, it is getting in the mainstream a little bit more, but most people don't even know that stuff. So if some Pakistani or some Yemenite or whatever that what he would be called, they come over here and blow up one of our subways or something, they'd be like, "Oh, why do they hate us?" And no idea that we've dropped 3,000 bombs on them, and that's no exaggeration, 3,000 bombs in Yemen over the last 5 or 6 years, I've been told. So anyway, I digress. Is he a Japanese American? Is that?
I'm not sure if he is or not, but I've never seen him. Maybe I've seen him interviewed, but I certainly have caught excerpts from a number of his books and his.
Yeah, I saw an interview that he did on YouTube And maybe he was talking about what happened in Japan. Maybe that's why I thought he was a Japanese-American. I can't remember. Yeah, he's excellent, though. And they cited him in some of those Ron Paulish type videos. I know they gave clips of him talking about Blowback. And
he's very seasoned. He spent a lot of time with these folks.
Yeah, he's excellent. So number two. Number one was mind your own business. Number two is obey the golden rule. Okay, so as we know in Luke 6:31, Jesus gave us what has been called the golden rule. And it's one of the best possible rules that you could live by. And this isn't even just a Christian thing. There have been all kinds of world religious leaders like Gandhi and Buddha and all those type of people that recognize this principle. I mean, this is just a good principle to live by. In Luke 6:31, and it said, Jesus said, "And as ye would that men should do to you, do ye also to them likewise." So, treat men how you want them to treat you. If you want somebody to treat you good, then treat them good. It just makes sense. This is also summed up in what Jesus said in Matthew 22:39, "Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself." In Matthew 22:39. He said, and the second is like unto it. The first and greatest commandment, he said, was to love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. That's the first and greatest one. Then he says in verse 39, and the second is like unto it, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. So if you've fulfilled those two commandments, you've kept all the law and the prophets, because you're not going to steal from your neighbor if you love him as yourself. You're not going to kill him. You're not going to commit adultery with his wife. You're not going to covet his possessions. If you love the Lord your God above all else, you're not going to have idols in your heart. You're not going to blaspheme his name. So all the law and the prophets hang on those two commandments right there. But anyway, that's just, in other words, treat others as you would want them to treat you. It's pretty simple. I mean, let me break it down really simple. Don't murder people that haven't attacked you. You know, this isn't like rocket science. This isn't some, you know, crazy thing that nobody's ever thought of before. It's pretty simple. Don't murder people that haven't attacked you. I mean, if I could say to Barack Obama, if I could give him my piece of advice, if I ever get invited over to the White House for a prayer meet, for a prayer breakfast or something, I'd tell him, don't murder people that haven't attacked you. And if you're given the command to drop a bomb on somebody in another country that hasn't attacked us, like Anwar al-Awlaki, American citizen in Yemen, we dropped a Hellfire missile on him from a drone. Killed him. American citizen, uncondemned, gave no justification for it. All they say, he's a bad guy, he's a terrorist. Maybe he was, who knows, but he had no trial, he had no nothing. And then his son also, 16-year-old son, out at a barbecue, dropped a bomb on him too, killed him too. Two American citizens. So I would tell Mr. Obama to not murder people that haven't attacked you. Pretty basic. Ron Paul got booed in South Carolina, the Bible Belt, as they call it, if you remember this, for saying that we ought to adopt a golden rule in foreign policy. I remember that debate in South Carolina. He said, why don't we adopt a golden rule in foreign policy and treat other nations as we want them to treat us? And he got booed in the Bible Belt. I mean, come on. He didn't say that we shouldn't defend ourselves if we're attacked. He said we should treat them the way we want them to treat us. I mean, how would we feel if China was over here flying 1,000 drones over our head every day and dropping bombs on us and killing people? I mean, how would we feel? How would we feel if they invaded our country to deliver us from evil and threw out Barack Obama from the White House and delivered us from this oppressive government and the NSA that's watching our and listening to our every move? Would we welcome the Chinese with open arms and thank you for saving us? No, we'd fight them tooth and nail. I mean, just think about it. Treat people the way you'd want them to treat you. It's not that difficult. All right, number three, act only in self-defense and don't initiate violence. This is one of the pillars of non-intervention. Act only in self-defense. You don't initiate violence. And that should go for individuals, and it should go for governments. Governments shouldn't initiate violence. They shouldn't initiate violence on their citizens either. Governments should only be reactive, just like people should be reactive. If you commit a crime, then the government can inflict violence on you if they have to bring you to justice, to execute you if you've committed a capital offense or something like that. But they don't initiate violence. They shouldn't. And neither should we. We shouldn't, you know, we don't fight unless we're attacked. That just makes good sense. Peter, whenever they came to get Jesus and the disciples in the garden, and I talked a lot about this in the last study on when to defend yourself and when not to, but there in Luke 22, they came to get, the band of men came with Judas to get Jesus, and Peter had the right, whenever that happened, he had the right to self-defense. Let's look here in Luke 22, 36. So this is prior to that happening. I've been over this I think this has been over these in the last two studies, so a third time is a charm, I suppose, superstitious, which I'm not. So anyway, Luke 22, 36. Jesus he's speaking to the disciples. He had sent them out prior to this, and he told them at that time, don't take purse or scrip with you, don't take any money, don't worry about it, don't take two coats, just go into the first house you find. If they take care of you, then, and they bid you well, then fine, stay there. If not, wipe the dust off your feet and move on. But don't take anything with you and don't worry about yourself. Well, he says unto them in verse 36, then said he unto them, but now, he that hath a purse, let him take it, and likewise his scrip, which is his bag. And he that hath no sword, let him sell his garment and buy one. For I say unto you that this is written, must yet be accomplished in me. And he was reckoned among the transgressors, for the things concerning me have an end. And they said, Lord, behold, here are two swords. And he said unto them, it is enough. So as I said before, two swords is enough. It's enough to have two weapons of defense on you. You got fault tolerance and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, Peter had the right to self-defense. Now, whenever they came to get Jesus, there had been things happened prior to that, information that Peter had that he should have thought of and used. Jesus had told Peter that he would be killed by the Jewish leaders and even rebuked Peter for refusing to believe it. In Matthew 16, I just want to kind of build up to what happened here in the garden and just show you that Peter acted out when he shouldn't have. Peter initiated violence. In Matthew 16, 21 through 23, from that time forth began Jesus to show unto his disciples how that he must go unto Jerusalem and suffer many things of the elders and chief priests and scribes, and be killed and be raised again the third day. Then Peter took him and began to rebuke him, saying, be it far from thee, Lord, this shall not be unto thee. Can you imagine Jesus tells you something's going to happen? You say, oh, no, no, that's not going to happen, Jesus. Wow. That's something. But how many times do we say something like that? Jesus says, you know, if you do certain things, this is going to happen to you. Oh, no, it's not going to happen to me. I'm sure that won't happen to me. He's telling you something in his word. And if he tells you it's going to happen, it's going to happen. Verse 23, but he turned and said unto Peter, get thee behind me, Satan. Thou art an offense unto me, for thou savorest not the things that be of God, but those that be of men. So poor Peter there. I mean, just about less than 10 verses later, he said, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. He said, blessed art thou, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood hath not revealed it unto thee, but my Father's in heaven. Less than 10 verses later, he calls him Satan, tells him to get behind me. He's an offense unto him. So it just shows you that Jesus doesn't pull any punches. And he will commend you when you're right and turn around in the same breath and tell you when you're wrong. So anyway.
I made a note here, and I heard this before, that Peter really acted out in his own self-interest. And it was interesting when that was brought up, because if you think about it, Peter, of course, did not want to see Christ die.
Of course.
And all that, but it was more for, I hate to lose you, I don't want to lose you,
yep,
etc.
Yep.
You know, and so it was an interesting approach to it, whether, as we do, our self-interest rises far
right
further than we're willing to admit,
yep,
when we're so good about taking care of things,
yep,
watching out for things.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, because, I mean, they were companions. Jesus was one of his three closest friends, Peter, James, and John. And so, yeah, I mean, you can imagine not wanting to hear bad news like that and say, oh, no, 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 that's not going to happen to you, Jesus. Definitely not. Jesus had prayed for God's will to be done. So not only did he say that it was going to happen, he was going to be delivered unto the chief priests and scribes and be killed, he even prayed that God's will would be done. Jesus was okay with this happening. Now, Peter apparently was not. In Matthew 26, 42, Matthew 26:42, speaking of Jesus, and he went away again the second time and prayed, saying, O my Father, if this cup may not pass away from me, except I drink it, thy will be done. So Jesus had prayed for God's will to be done. Therefore, whenever Peter stepped up in John 18, when they came to get him, it says there in John 18, 9 through 10, that the saying might be fulfilled at which he spake, of them which thou gavest me I have lost none, or have I lost none. Then Peter, having a sword, drew it and smote the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear, and the servant's name was Malchus. Then said Jesus unto Peter, put up thy sword into the sheath. The cup which my Father hath given me, shall not I drink it. So Peter stepped over the line when he initiated violence. He was told this was going to happen. This was God's will to happen. Jesus, as I mentioned in the study last week, was a man able to defend himself. Peter wasn't defending somebody that couldn't defend themselves. He was not under obligation. He initiated violence. And as we just saw there in John 18, Jesus rebuked him for it. And he rebukes him even stronger in Matthew 26:51. He says to Peter there, you better watch it, because they that live by the sword will also die by it. Matthew 26:51-52. This is after Peter. Let's just get 52, after Peter cut the guy's ear off. Then said Jesus unto him, put again thy sword into his place, for all they that take the sword shall perish with the sword. So Jesus rebuked him for it, for initiating violence. Babylon. Babylon back in the Old Testament, the world empire, the fourth world empire. I think it was fourth, right? Yeah, it was fourth. Egypt, Assyria, no, third. Third world empire, right? Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Medo-Persian, Greeks, Romans. Third world empire, yeah. Babylon was judged for her imperialism. Look in Habakkuk, if you can find it. It's back there. Back in the Minor Prophets, it's right before Zephaniah. If you can find Zephaniah, Zephaniah is just before Zechariah and Haggai. So Zechariah is right before Malachi. So if you go Malachi, Zechariah, Haggai, Zephaniah, and then Habakkuk, going from front to back, or back to front, however you want to look at it. Habakkuk 2:5-13. So let's look at the Lord's rebuke here to the Chaldeans, to Babylon. You can see this is Babylon, just in case you want to look. In Habakkuk 1:6, it says, for lo, I raise up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation, which shall march through the breadth of the land to possess the dwelling places that are not theirs. So the Chaldeans, that's another name for Babylon. The Babylonians and the Chaldeans are the same. That's the same thing. So in Habakkuk 2, and we're going to read verses 5-13. It said, yea also, because he transgresseth by wine, he is a proud man, neither keepeth at home. And just I want you to notice as we read through this, look at the singular pronouns that are used here. He, referring to the nation, calling him a he. Yea also, because he transgresseth by wine, he is a proud man, neither keepeth at home, who enlargeth his desire as hell, and is as death, and cannot be satisfied, but gathereth unto him all nations, and heapeth unto him all people. Shall not all these take up a parable against him, and a taunting proverb against him, and say, woe to him that increaseth that which is not his. How long? And to him that ladeth himself with thick clay. Shall they not rise up suddenly that shall bite thee, and awake that shall vex thee, and thou shalt be for booties unto them? Because thou hast spoiled many nations, all the remnant of the people shall spoil thee, because of men's blood, and for the violence of the land, of the city, and of all that dwell therein. Woe to him that coveteth an evil covetousness to his house, and that he may set up his nest on high, that he may be delivered from the power of evil. Thou hast consulted shame to thy house, by cutting off many people, and has sinned against thy soul. For the stone shall cry out of the wall, and the beam out of the timber shall answer it. Woe to him that buildeth a town with blood and establisheth a city by iniquity. Behold, is it not of the Lord of hosts that the people shall labor in very fire, and the people shall weary themselves for very vanity? So I'm going to go through, we're going to go through those verses here, and I want to pull out some points from that. But notice how Babylon was judged for her imperialism there, or for his imperialism. I guess it's referred to as a he there. Babylon, who are the Chaldeans, like I saw, we already saw there in Habakkuk 1 and verse 6, was referred to as a man. I just pointed that out. And in Habakkuk 2 and verse 5, said, yea, also, because he transgresseth by wine, he is a proud man. So we weren't too far off when we said that nations can be under the same rules as men, because nations are referred to as men. Men doing things to other men. Look at what else was said of Babylon. They didn't keep it home. Habakkuk 2:5. He is a proud man, neither keepeth at home. So he wasn't minding his own business. He wasn't staying in his own lane, if you can imagine that. Look at Proverbs 27 and verse 8. So you're going to see all these things that Babylon was condemned for. I'm going to show you that people, that men, are condemned likewise for the same thing. Babylon was being held to the same rule as men. In Proverbs 27 and verse 8. As a bird that wandereth from her nest, so is a man that wandereth from his place. So it's not good when a man wanders from his place. He ought to stay at home, so to speak. Anyway, obviously he can go to work or that kind of thing. But he ought not to be meddling in other affairs. He ought not to be leaving his place. And the same thing was said of the strange woman in Proverbs 7, that her feet abide not in her house. She's out in the street. She's out running around doing things she ought not to. So Babylon was condemned for the same thing, not staying at home. Babylon also could not be satisfied and had to continue conquering nations and people. Habakkuk 2:5. Let's keep reading there. Who enlargeth his desire as hell and is as death and cannot be satisfied, but gathereth unto him all nations and heapeth unto him all people. I mean, you talk about it, that is the definition of imperialism. He just cannot be satisfied. It can never be enough. I think it was said of Alexander the Great, when he basically conquered the entire world, he sat there and cried like a baby because he had nobody else left to conquer. And the poor kid died at, what, 26 years old or something like that? Yeah. But yeah, he cried because he had nobody left to conquer. I mean, these people, they're psychopaths and sociopaths. They love to kill other people. They don't personally love to do it. They love to send other people out to do it for them. You know, if Barack Obama wants to go to war with Syria or he wants to go to war with Iran, get out there and lead the charge. Seriously. Get out there, be a commander, and get on the front lines. Take your wife and kids with you, too. You want women to be in the military so bad? Send your little girls out there. Send your wife out there. These guys are a bunch of chicken hawks is what they are. Sitting in their...
That was Jesse's term.
Yep, absolutely. Sitting in their plush White House or their plush mansions or whatever, sending other people's kids out there to get killed for their stupid wars that we have no business being in. So anyway, and I'm not talking about wars of self-defense, but we haven't had one of them for about 200 and some years, so anyway. Where was I?
Five.
Yes. Yes, he could not be satisfied. It was never enough. Compare that with Proverbs 27 and verse 20. I guess I should have kept my finger back there in Proverbs. I got to give it to John McCain, although I can't stand the guy. At least he was over there. He was a POW. If there's anybody that ought to be a hawk, I guess it could be him. Nobody could accuse him, at least, of not being there. Now, why in the world, if you'd spent all those years in a POW camp, why you'd want to do that to anybody else, I have no idea. Especially for such a stupid war as Vietnam. I mean, I wasn't around back then. But I still wonder, like, why in the world were we over there? I suppose people will think the same thing in 30 years from now when they say, why were we in Afghanistan? Why were we in Iraq and Libya and Syria and who knows where else?
But, and to fulfill his dad's wish to, his dad was a big one. So he was, he didn't want to show that he was not another. Military.
Yeah.
Sometimes this prodigy of military people, they like second, third generation.
Really?
They say, wow, you know, my dad, my grandpa, my great-grandpa, now.
Yeah.
some getting a bad war, some making it without any problems.
Yeah, just like Lieutenant Dan and Forrest Gump. You know, his grandfather and his father and his everybody died, and he wanted to die too. And so anyway, Proverbs 27 verse 20. It says, hell and destruction are never full, so the eyes of man are never satisfied. They never are. It is never enough. Let me see if I can find the verse in Proverbs 30, when it says that there are three things that say it's not enough. Where is it? Yeah, here we go. This is Tim's favorite verse, one of them. The horse leech, verse 15, sorry, Proverbs 30:15. The horse leech hath two daughters crying, give, give. That's what Pastor Tim says. He's Pastor Horse Leech, has two daughters crying, give, give. there are three things that are never satisfied. Yea, four things say not, it is enough. The grave and the barren womb, the earth that is not filled with water, and the fire that saith not, it is enough. And isn't that the case? And you could add in there, you know, the U.S. government, it's never enough. It's never enough taxes. It's never enough war. It's never enough surveillance. It's never enough anything for them.
It's the definition of an empire.
Yep, absolutely. And unfortunately, all empires fall, they collapse under their own weight economically, and that's going to happen to us. I'm certain of it. History will repeat itself over and over again. Babylon also took what was not theirs. Habakkuk 2 and verse 6. Shall not all these take up a parable against him and a taunting proverb against him and say, woe to him that increaseth that which is not his, how long? And to him that ladeth himself with thick clay. So they pronounce a woe on him that increaseth that which is not his. He took what was not his own to take. What did John the Baptist tell the soldiers that came to him to be baptized? He said to, that's what it is when you got an outline. I jumped a place there. They did say to do violence to no man and be content with your wages, so they took what wasn't theirs too, but that's not the point that I was getting at. Once again, if I was smoother, I could have went right to it and then, you know, pretended like that's where I was going, but anyway. In Exodus 20:15, this is the good old Ten Commandments, and the seventh commandment, I believe, says, thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not steal. This is what Babylon was being condemned for. No, I'm sorry. It's the eighth commandment. Thou shalt not steal. So Babylon were a bunch of thieves. And we read in Ephesians 4:28, just for a New Testament counterpart of this, Paul says that let him that stole steal no more. In Ephesians 4, in verse 28, let him that stole steal no more, but rather let him labor, working with his hands, that which is good, that he may have to give to him that needeth. I say the same thing to our government. You that steal, steal no more. You're taking too many taxes. To the Federal Reserve, thou that steal, steal no more. Stop stealing our money through inflation. Stop destroying our money supply. Get a real job. And that's what he says here. But rather let him labor, working with his hands, that which is good, that he may have to give to him that needeth. So get a real job. That's what I see all these neocons and all these defense contractors. Get a real job. Quit stealing from the public. Babylon did violence to others in Habakkuk 2 and verse 8. Habakkuk 2 and verse 8. Because thou hast spoiled many nations, all the remnant of the people shall spoil thee, because of men's blood and for the violence of the land, of the city, and of all that dwell therein. So they spoiled nations, they did violence. And because of men's blood, for the violence of the land, I'm sorry, that they would be spoiled because of man's blood and for because of the violence that they did. And that's what happened to Assyria. You know, God said that they, and I'm going to get into that here in a couple weeks, but Assyria was the rod in God's hand, the rod of his anger. It was said he sent Syria to punish a hypocritical nation, to punish the nation of Israel. But then the proud heart of the king of Assyria, he thought that it was himself, that he had done all this, and he had gotten all this wealth and all this victory himself. And God says, when I'm done with him, I'm going to punish the stout heart of the king of Assyria, the proud heart. So that was going to happen to Babylon here too. Because they had done violence to the blood of men, it was going to happen to them also. Sennacherib? Yep, or Sennacherib, yep. Yep. What's interesting there, I think that was the same one. They found a relic or an artifact. It was this big, I guess it was like a cone, and they had all the nations and cities that Sennacherib, king of Assyria, had taken, and he went the whole way, and they found this thing over in the Middle East somewhere, and they have, it's nation after nation going up this thing, and it gets the whole way, and he went up against Jerusalem, and then that was the end of it. Because that's when God, I think that, was that the same time when God sent an angel and killed 185,000 of them?
Yep. Hezekiah, Isaiah.
Yep.
Isaiah told Hezekiah,
yep,
that this is going to happen.
Yep.
And then Hezekiah, you know, said, you know, and then he really, you know, he cried, and he was also smitten by that same plague.
Yep.
And then he got better after that.
Yeah, Hezekiah went into the house of God. Sennacherib went into the house of his gods and got killed.
Yeah. Right. But you're right. I think it was 100. It was a huge number, 185,000.
Yep.
But it was interesting because that was done via a plague rather than the sword.
Yeah.
So here again, we see an example of God's, you know, can do what he wants to do in any way.
Absolutely.
Via sword, yep, and a plague.
Yep. Just interesting there in history, though, that there you have an artifact proving it, you know, and he went up against Jerusalem, and that's the that's the end of it. No more nations on that thing. So yeah, exactly. I mean, God's arm is not short that it cannot save yet or cannot destroy, and he can. I mean, all he has to do is let that great big whatever that big volcano in Yellowstone. I forget what it's, what do they call that thing? Anyway. If that thing would explode, they say it would cover most of the United States in about 4 feet of ash. So, I mean, all God has to do is just tweak one little thing and we're toast. I mean, he can easily do it. No problem. When I went to Yellowstone, I went to see Conrad right after that, and Conrad said, "You went there, you're crazy, that thing's gonna blow up." It wouldn't matter anyway. I mean, it blows up when I'm on it. I'd just be killed instantly. I wouldn't have to starve to death like the rest of you suckers, you know? So.
We'd be a few miles away.
Yeah. So anyway, he did violence to others, and that's what John the Baptist said to those soldiers in Luke 3:14, do violence to no man. So these are New Testament commands as well. In Habakkuk 2:9, Babylon was said that they coveted. Habakkuk 2:9, woe to him that coveteth an evil covetousness to his house, that he may set his nest on high, that he may be delivered from the power of evil. So he was coveting other people's possessions. And individuals likewise, Christians, are told this in Colossians 3:5, that one of the things that we're supposed to mortify is covetousness, which is idolatry, it says. In Colossians 3:5, mortify therefore your members which are upon the earth, fornication, uncleanness, inordinate affection, evil concupiscence, and covetousness, which is idolatry. So covetousness is something that we as individuals are judged for, and Babylon as a nation was likewise being judged for. And lastly, of Babylon, they killed people, which was a sin in this case. These were not wars of self-defense for Babylon. These were wars of aggression and imperialism. Habakkuk, now why did I went and turned from it. Now it would probably take me 10 minutes to find it again. Keep turning here. Habakkuk 2:10, thou hast consulted shame to thy house by cutting off many people, and hast sinned against thy soul. They cut off many people. What did Jesus say when he was quoting the Ten Commandments in Mark 10:19? Thou shalt not kill. You know, we're not supposed to kill people unless it's in self-defense. We're not supposed to just, you know, go out there and kill people. Some people have this idea that it's not murder if it's war. It's like all of a sudden if we declare war. We don't even declare war. But even if we did, all of a sudden, oh, it's not murder anymore. It's like we can declare war for any reason. It wouldn't matter what the reason was. We could just want to go wipe some people out because we don't like the color of their skin. And, A, it's war. War is hell and all the other stuff they say. And all of a sudden, it ceases to be murder, and it's war, quote unquote. What's the difference? I mean, unprovoked aggression is unprovoked aggression, whether it's on a national scale or a personal scale. I see no difference whatsoever. Now, no government has the right to tell its citizens to kill other people who didn't attack them. Now, we are supposed to obey the government. And I am not, certainly not saying that we're not. And I hope nobody ever gets that impression, though I do speak against the government sometimes. But I also have examples of that. Jesus called Herod a fox. He said, you tell that fox. The Old Testament prophets, like Elijah, you know, I forget which one it was. He said, thou profane wicked prince to one of the kings. I think it was the king of Israel. They spoke again. Look at what Elijah said to Ahab. Ahab said, art thou come, thou troubler of Israel? And he said, I have not troubled Israel, but thou and thy house. I mean, he flat out, I mean, condemned the king. So anyway, when you have wicked kings, there's nothing wrong with pointing out their wickedness. You shouldn't. You don't want to despise dominion. You don't want to speak evil of dignities. You don't want to make fun of Obama's big ears or something like that. I mean, that's not, you know, that kind of thing is not what we ought to be doing. But in making fun of people like that, disrespecting him or something, but to speak out against evil policies where we're dropping bombs and killing people that haven't attacked us, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. As far as I know, if there is, please tell me, because I certainly don't want to be under the judgment of God. But anyway, in Romans 13, 1 through 7, so we already read 1 through 4. Let's just read 5 through 7, just to show that we're supposed to obey civil magistrates. We're supposed to obey governments. It says, wherefore you must needs be subject not only for wrath, but also for conscience sake. For this cause pay ye tribute also, for they are God's ministers, attending continually upon this very thing. Render therefore to all their dues, tribute to whom tribute is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. Owe no man anything but to love one another, for he that loveth another hath fulfilled the law. So yeah, we're supposed to submit, we're supposed to obey, we're supposed to pay taxes. Jesus gave us that example when he paid taxes. Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's. I don't particularly like it. I think the income tax is unconstitutional, and you know, I have a whole bunch of thoughts about that. But anyway, I pay it. And you know, you got to pick your battles, I guess, and there's certainly nothing wrong with paying it. Now, if it gets to the point where they say you owe me 85% or 90% or something where you couldn't provide for yourself and your family, well then, you know, you don't pay it anymore. And you do civil disobedience. You do like Gideon did when he threshed wheat by the wine press to hide it from the Midianites. The Midianites had taken over and basically wouldn't allow them to grow their own crops. They couldn't provide for themselves. And Gideon was threshing wheat behind the wine press. He was hiding it from the government. And when God found him, he didn't say, oh, you IRS-hating tax evader, you. No, he said, thou mighty man of valor. He praised him for doing that. So anyway. And in 1 Peter 2:13-17. 1 Peter 2:13-17. It says, submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether it be to the king as supreme or unto governors, as unto them that are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of them that do well. For so is the will of God, that with well-doing ye may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men, as free, not using your liberty as a cloak of maliciousness, but as the servants of God. Honor all men, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. So we are supposed to submit ourselves to every ordinance of man, as unto governors, as unto them that are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of them that do well. Virtually the same thing was said in Romans 13. That's what the government is there for, is for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of them that do well. There comes a point when the government ceases to do that, when their punishment of them, when they punish those that do well, and that they protect evildoers, there's some point at which where you don't submit to that government anymore, because they are not a government that's instituted by God when they're doing the exact opposite of what God has said. And that's a dicey subject, and I'm not going to get into that tonight. But there comes a point where you have to obey God rather than men. I mean, that's clear. If they're telling you to do something that God tells you not to do, don't do it. If they're telling you not to do something that God tells you to do, do it. We have to obey God rather than men. So we are obliged, we're only obliged to obey them as far as they're exercising their legal and legitimate authority. We must not obey when they've demanded that we do something which is forbidden by God, which is the verses that I was just referring to. Acts 4 and verse 19. Another good one would be the three Hebrew children, Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego, when the king told them that they were going to worship the image, and they said, or he's going to throw them in a burning fiery furnace, and they said, and they were very respectful, but they said, you know, whether you throw us in the furnace or not, God's able to deliver us, and even if he doesn't, we're still not going to worship the image you've set up. We're not going to do it. They disobeyed the government because the government told them to do something that God told them not to do. So that's back there in Daniel. You get that. Daniel chapter 3, I think. Let's see. Daniel, yeah. So let's see if I can find the verse that I was talking about was verse 17. Let me see if I can get, so in verse 10, Daniel 3:10, it says, "Thou, O king, hast made a decree that every man that shall hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music, shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoso falleth not down and worshipeth that he should be, and worshipeth, that he should be cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace." So they talked the king into signing this decree, and in the law of the Medes and the Persians was it couldn't alter it, it couldn't go back. So when he signed it, he liked these guys, but there's nothing he could do about it. Same with Daniel in the lion's den. There's nothing he could do about it. So anyway, in verse 16, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said, so he basically tells them in the previous verse that if you don't fall down and worship this thing, then we're going to throw you in the midst of the burning fiery furnace. And he says at the end of that verse, "And who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands?" Well, he was about ready to find out who that God was. Anyway, it says, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer thee in this matter. If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thine hand, O king. But if not, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods, nor worship thy golden image, which thou hast set up." So they said, you know, king, God's able to deliver us, but even if he doesn't, we're still not going to worship that image. We'll be burned alive rather than do something that God told us not to do. And that is our absolute line in the sand. There's a lot of gray areas, but that's a line in the sand right there. When the government says to do something God said not to do, or to not do something he said to do. If the government tells us tomorrow, you cannot go and worship in a church that's not a state-sanctioned church, hitherto shalt thou come and no further. I wouldn't paint a bullseye on us. I wouldn't advertise where we're meeting. I wouldn't try to be a martyr. But we're going to worship God in the true church of God. And we're not going to pay any attention to what they say. So anyway.
That's been done.
Absolutely. Yep, it certainly has. Yep. They hid away in the caves and the mountains and, yeah, in Italy and France. Yep, in China. I mean, there's underground churches in China and Russia and absolutely. Yep, you got to do it. And what are you going to do? Go to some state-approved church? And you know, that's not going to work, not with me. Acts 4 and verse 19. So they commanded, these men commanded Peter not to speak in the name of Jesus. But Peter and John answered and said unto them, "Whether it be right in the sight of God to hearken unto you more than unto God, judge ye, for we cannot but speak the things which we have seen and heard." So they were commanded to speak it, and they told them, the authorities told them not to speak it, and they said, "Well, you judge whether we listen to you or God, but we're going to speak what God told us to speak." And then in Acts 5, verse 29, I'd recommend memorizing this verse. I use it so many times, so frequently, and we'll probably become very acquainted and familiar with it, I think, in the future, if things keep going the way they have been. In Acts 5:29, "Then Peter and the other apostles answered and said, we ought to obey God rather than men." So that's the line in the sand, like I said. So a government, therefore, cannot compel a person to kill another person. I mean, think about it. If my government said, we want you to go kill your next door neighbor in the next apartment down because he's a bad guy. Well, I'm going to say, no, I'm not going to do that. I mean, why would I kill somebody that hasn't done nothing to me? I don't even know if he's a bad guy. I mean, I'm not going to do that. I mean, God tells me that I'm not supposed to kill. I'm not supposed to murder. So what's the difference if they say, I want you to kill this bad guy 6,000 miles across the ocean on foreign soil, and I'm going to say, he hasn't attacked me. I don't even know who he is. I don't even know if he's a bad guy. What's the difference? Distance makes no difference. As far as I'm concerned, whether it's 6,000 miles or 6 feet down the hall, it doesn't make any difference. Whether they're of another nationality and they speak another language and their skin's a different color doesn't make any difference. You don't kill people that haven't attacked you, no matter if the government tells you to or not. And this is why I will not be drafted. Now, I've been in the military. I don't even know if I can be drafted. I don't know how that works. And I may even be too old now. I don't know. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I won't be drafted. I mean, if they came to me and said, you know, we need a draft, we're starting another war, wherever, no, I'm not going. I mean, I'd go to jail before I'd be drafted. I just won't do it. I'm not going to be a pawn in the hand of them again. Fortunately, I didn't have to kill anybody when I was over there, but I supported the whole mission that did. So, I mean, the military is just one big complex machine, so those who are supporting it are aiding them who are doing it, and I wouldn't be a part of it. I mean, I won't do it.
In my time, the draft was on, so I went in before they got me on the draft, just because I was ready. But the the whole era of draft dodgers, quote unquote, the whole era of even Muhammad Ali, Cassius Clay, said he's not going, and so that era was full of those that went to Canada.
Yep.
Some never.
Never,
huh? I would have gone to Canada. Well, some never were able to come back. Some just, then they said the amnesty. But it was a very, very tense time. And families were pitted against families. And, and neighbors against neighbors, brothers against sisters and brothers.
Yeah.
And for that very reason, and then, of course, the ability to be in a non-combat mode was one of the issues that were, there was a lot of that at that time.
What I used to think too, whenever I, because I grew up with all this propaganda and everything about Vietnam, and think all the draft dodgers, they were just these sissies, these evil people or whatever. And the thing is, a lot of people get duped and they don't know. I'm gonna when I finish up here, and it's only gonna be a couple more minutes. I want to make some qualifications to what I've been saying here. It's one thing if you've been duped into it, if you've been bought into the propaganda or whatever. Anyway, I'll get into that in just a second. But that's why I would refuse to be drafted. That's why one of the reasons why I got out of the military. I told them I don't agree with their foreign policy anymore, and they talked to me a little bit, but they didn't. It wasn't a point where they were going to debate it with me or anything else. And I wouldn't do it. And this may sound bad, but I wouldn't recommend to any young person today, nowadays, post 9/11, to join in the military at all. I would strongly recommend not joining the military. You would end up being put in a position where you might have to do terrible things that you don't want to do. If you blow the whistle, you'll be like Bradley Manning. You'll be in prison for the rest of your life to rot. I would not go in. Absolutely not. The thing is, if this country gets attacked, if we got attacked on our own soil and it was a legitimate war, you don't need a draft. People would be taking up arms and people would be fighting. So, in my opinion, a draft says that they own you, that they own your body, and that they can do with you what you want. They don't own me. My Bible says that I'm bought with a price, and it wasn't the U.S. government bought me with a price. It was Jesus Christ. They don't own my body, and I'm not going anywhere to be anybody's killing machine. So, anyway, be that as it may. So if your government has put you in such a position, either against your will or by lying to you and convincing you by propaganda, then they're the ones that have the greater sin. So if you ended up in a war and you had to kill somebody and you thought it was the right thing to do, I thought the Iraq War was the right thing to do in 2003. By the time 05 rolled around, when I got deployed the second time, I didn't think it was the right thing to do, and I was stuck and I went. But, they use the propaganda, and you think it's the right thing to do, and you're all for it. If you've been lied to, they have the greater sin. If you were forced into it, they have the greater sin. And I'll give you a verse for that. John 19 and verse 11. When I say all these things against all this imperialism and this foreign policy, I'm not speaking to individual soldiers that are duped and that have been just propagandized into this stuff. I'm talking about the people that are behind it and the people that are doing it and causing it. In John 19 and verse 11, Jesus answered, he's speaking to Pilate here, because Pilate said he had the power to release him if he wanted. Jesus said, "Thou couldest have no power at all against me, except it were given thee from above. Therefore he that delivered me unto thee hath the greater sin." The Jews that delivered Jesus unto him, they had the greater sin. Whatever Pilate ended up doing, Pilate might have been the executioner, just like the soldiers out there. He's the one kicking in doors. The ones that delivered him had the greater sin. The Jews were charged with the crucifixion of Christ. Peter lays it on them. He didn't lay it on Pilate. He laid it on them. They were the ones that had the greater sin. And God has mercy on us when we do things in ignorance. If you look in Acts 3:17, so if your government sent you over there and you ended up having to kill somebody or whatever, you saw terrible things, you just remember, God has mercy on people that do things in ignorance and or that you get put in a position that you didn't want to be in. Acts 3 and verse 17, Peter preaching to these Jews, and he says, "And now, brethren, I wot that through ignorance ye did it, as did also your rulers." He's speaking about crucifying Christ. He said in verse 14, "But ye denied the Holy One and the just, and desired a murderer to be granted unto you, and killed the Prince of Life, whom God hath raised from the dead, whereof we are witnesses." So he said he wot through ignorance that they did it. God has mercy on those that do things in ignorance. Some of those same people were converted, ended up being converted. So if you were put in that position by your government, you were acting in self-defense to preserve your own life. If you think about it, whether it's a war of aggression, and we have no business being there like almost every war we've been in since the Revolution, probably 1812, I don't know, I mean that. We were supposedly attacked by Japan, but I mean, I think that's been well established now that we allowed that. Well, number one, we caused it to happen by embargoing them and not allowing them to get the natural resources they needed. Number two, we knew it was coming. We cracked the code a long time before. So anyway, we got ourselves into that one. So barring that, we haven't been in a self-defense war at least since 1812, and I think that's even debatable, because I think from what I've read, we were over there messing around and provoking that one too. But anyway, it's been a long, long time since we've been in a war of self-defense. But anyway, if you're in one of these wars that was a provoked war, that was not a war of self-defense, when you're on the front line and you're fighting, you're not fighting for the United States. You're not fighting for the flag or freedom or liberty or democracy. You're fighting to save your own life and the guy next to you. That's who you're fighting for. You are fighting, at that point, it's self-defense. You're thrown into a situation you don't even want to be in, which may be a war of aggression on our politicians' part, but at that point, you're being shot at and you're defending yourself. So when you go over there, if you've been over there and you had to do that, it was self-defense, and God will have mercy on your ignorance. But the psychopaths and sociopaths that sent you over there, I don't see him having quite so much mercy on them. So anyway, that's what I have to say about non-intervention for tonight. Next time I'm going to talk about the just war theory. I'm going to read through some quotes of the just war theory. I'm going to talk about our own policies, like what the Founding Fathers said, what George Washington said in his farewell address, which ought to be required reading for every member of Congress and every school child, as far as I'm concerned. What Jefferson said, what John Quincy Adams said, that America goes not in search of monsters to destroy and is a winner of nobody's freedom but her own. And look at what the Constitution says. Anyway, so we'll get into all that kind of stuff next time, Lord willing. And then I also want to talk about how these wars promote debt and deficits and paper money and all that kind of stuff. So we'll kind of wrap all that into it as well. So I hope you got a blessing from this.
Yeah, thanks.